Now, Edward R. Murrow and the voices of President Harry Truman, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, General James Van Fleet, Hank Greenberg, Serge Koussevitzky, the men of the 4th Infantry Division, and more than 40 other men and women in the news in the 26th performance of Hear It Now, presented tonight and every week at this time.
Business as usual has an ominous ring to me at a time when men are dying in battle in Korea for a free way of life. We're sitting on an economic time bomb.
It was dark, and I went up to one, and hey, you. And he turned around. I was only about 4 feet away from him. He shot me in the chest. It was a Chinaman.
Last half of the first with two out. Lopez makes ready. He pitches. It's swung on. A fly ball going into left field. Going back for it is Woodling. Still going back. It's going, going, going for a home run.
Hear It Now. The Columbia Broadcasting System and 173 affiliated radio stations present a document for air based on the week's news and the men and women who made it. All the voices and sounds you will hear are real and are presented as they were recorded in the heat and confusion of a world in crisis. Here is the editor of Hear It Now, the distinguished reporter and news analyst, Edward R. Murrow.
On certain Mondays, the high-ceilinged marbled chamber of the Supreme Court building in Washington always plays to its biggest audiences, for it is on Monday that the highest court in the land hands down its decisions. This Monday, the crowd was even larger than usual.
The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States.
There was no little tension in the court that has directed so much of our law in recent years. A vital decision was about to be announced. Thomas Perry Lippitt, the court crier.
Oh, yay! Oh, yay! Oh, yay! All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Chief Justice Vinson, seated in the middle of the nine justices, began to read the court's ruling on a trial that had ended in New York City before Judge Harold Medina in October of 1949. After a jury trial which had lasted 9 months, Judge Medina had sentenced 11 communists to prison terms and fines. The defendants had appealed the decision to the Supreme Court. Last December, Solicitor General Philip Perlman, whose job it is to represent the government in such trials, made his final plea to the Supreme Court and asked that the New York conviction be upheld. Mr. Perlman said,
"The communists who have been convicted of conspiring to advocate and teach the desirability of overthrowing the government of the United States by force and violence claim that they are protected by the freedom of speech and of the press guaranteed by the First Amendment to the Constitution. They claim that the Communist Party in this country is a political party, and that they are merely advocating and supporting political ideas. The Communist Party is not a political party, as we know political parties in this country. It is a conspiracy directed from Moscow. The Bill of Rights of the Constitution was never intended to be a hiding place for the enemies of the state, and a convenient underground for conspirators in the service of foreign governments and organizations."
On Monday morning, the Solicitor General's plea and the New York federal jury's verdict were upheld. In reading the 7,700-word majority opinion, the Chief Justice went back to Oliver Wendell Holmes' Clear and Present Danger and said, in effect, that Justice Holmes' statement that free speech is hazardous only where such a danger exists cannot mean that before the government may act, it must wait until a putsch is about to be executed. Two members of the court, Justices Douglas and Black, dissented, suggesting that the Constitution's free speech provision had been watered down. The defendants must now serve prison terms of from 3 to 5 years and pay $10,000 fines. 9,000 miles away from this decision, a tough, tired, successful Eighth Army was trying to win another decision over a clear and present danger as it exists on the Korean battlefield. Allied troops pushed forward slowly against increasingly determined enemy artillery fire. And at his headquarters, General Van Fleet, the Eighth Army commander, summed up for the free world what his troops had done and what they are now trying to do. General Van Fleet on the victory of the past.
The well-timed and aggressive UN counteroffensive, utilizing artillery and air support to the best advantage, inflicted a terrible toll in killed and wounded. Approximately 10,000 Chinese were captured, some in large groups, and while many show signs of physical exhaustion, as well as ravenous hunger, others were in excellent physical condition and were fully capable of continuing the fight except for realizing their hopeless situation. While the inventory of major items of captured equipment is incomplete, the following advanced reports have been received. Over 11,000 rifles, 1,000 machine guns, 310 mortars, 120 artillery pieces of various caliber, large quantities of ammunition of all types, 51 truckloads of rations, and 400 horses. However, while crippled severely, the enemy is not exhausted, since his known reserves in forward areas are sufficient for still another round.
And now the general tells us what his United Nations troops will do in the future.
The Eighth Army's pursuit phase has now ended with the clearing again of enemy units from South Korea. The Eighth Army will continue, however, to stop the enemy's unwarranted aggression against South Korea and will, when necessary and profitable, meet such threats within North Korea.
On the East Central Front, where the fighting is still the heaviest, correspondent James Greenfield of the Voice of America was able to study and record some of the enemy's offensive ability. Greenfield was up front with a Turkish mortar company, which was trying to flush a Chinese unit from a nearby hill. You can hear the Turkish mortars going out, then some unexpected incoming mail with a red postmark. And if you listen closely, you can hear not only the shell, but the correspondent and his recording gear landing in a rice-flooded paddy as a result of the concussion.
We're now situated just about at the bottom of the hill, and those noises you hear directly in front of you are Turkish troops firing mortar shells. There goes another mortar down that pipe and up. Those mortars go high in the air and fall directly on those hills just beyond which is our objective. And here comes some more mortars as we're about to move closer up on this hill. They're coming from all around me, both behind and back of me, and as I look up into the sky, I can actually see the shells passing over me and onto the hill in front of me. So the enemy shells are coming in a little closer, but one of the Turkish officers said we're going to advance. Anyway, that one was about, I'll imagine, about 45 yards from where I'm standing. They're coming in pretty close now, and
the correspondent picks himself up.
I'd like to put a little editorial postscript on this recording you've just heard. A few things happened. I was moving back towards the road in which the mortars were shooting across a rice paddy when a heavy Chinese communist shell landed in the rice paddy and flipped me over and threw me in the machine face down into the water of the rice paddy. And I wasn't hit directly. I was just stunned by the concussion. And I got up, and a second shell landed in the same rice paddy and knocked me almost into the next one over the small bit of dirt that separates these rice paddies to dikes. My leg was bent in back of me, and I couldn't stand very well, so I crawled through the water when about two other shells landed. All in all, it was quite a day.
One of our correspondents in Korea, Bob Pierpoint, spent last weekend with a fighter-bomber outfit, Jets. The only jet that will carry a reporter as well as the pilot is a T-33. The correspondent sort of hunches up piggyback behind the pilot. Here they are taking off.
We're heading down the runway now. The jet is underway. We're moving at a terrific speed. There we made it. A terrific downward thrust as we climb at this tremendous rate of speed. I should say now that we're probably 1,000 feet high and we've only been in the air some 30 or 40 seconds. We're still going up, but we are now heading northward toward the vicinity of the 38th parallel, where I understand that we are going to pick up the other planes in this strike. We're a little late, and we're heading at a tremendous speed. And now I get the warning to put on the oxygen masks.
The jet thrusts north over the green hills and yellow streams, picks up the rest of the flight, and starts looking for their mosquito plane, an old T-6 trainer, which will show them their target.
There goes an artillery explosion off to our right here. Now we are definitely behind enemy lines. You can see where our artillery is firing. Now there's a plane down below us, evidently coming in from the northeast. Well, that's our mosquito. I can see now. That's our mosquito. I can see the markings on it. Planes ahead of us dropped their bombs. We have no bombs on this plane, only 50 calibers, so that we're going to win and straight. But we have now circled the valley and seem to be coming back on that target for a strafing run.
The T-33 watches the rest of the flight bomb and then goes in for a strafing run. As they went twisting and turning down the valley, correspondent Pierpoint lost his lunch. And then something worse happened, which has happened before. As Major Higginback straightened out on his run and tripped his guns, the recorder went dead. Back on the ground, Major Higginback makes his report. It's all in the day's work. It's a casual Air Force out there.
We rendezvoused with a spotter aircraft about 10 miles south of Chorwan, and he had had some enemy troop positions sighted. So we went on in, and some of our ships had napalm, and the others had bombs. Well, I believe we covered the area they had spotted the troops in.
The casualties continued. This week, 925 new names were added to the list of killed, wounded, or missing. The total is now 68,352. Casualty figures, like deaths on a highway on a holiday weekend, are big, staggering, impersonal things, unless it's you or someone you know. At the 4th Field Hospital at the front in Korea, we recorded the sounds of four of those 68,352 and how they got on the Pentagon's weekly list.
Chinaman threw a grenade at me and hit me, just hit in the chin and in the knee by the grenade. And I went back to where the 4.2 mortars were, and I met these fellas that looked like they were supposed to be guarding the 4.2s. It was dark, and I went up to one, and, hey, you. And he turned around. I was only about 4 feet away from him. He shot me in the chest. It was a Chinaman. Then I rolled down this bank into the river down there, about 15 feet, and I played dead. And he took two more shots at me and missed. They ain't very good shots.
And an infantryman from Michigan who defines a potato masher.
I had buku burp guns, and I don't know, they had plenty of potato mashers up there. We couldn't get at them, that's all. They looked like a rolling pin. It hit right in among a lot of us, and none of them got hurt. Then I backed off this rock where I was on and fell about 10 feet, I guess, on more rocks on my spine. Oh, my spine seems to hurt more than anything. They said it was contusion, whatever that means.
And a GI from Tennessee who got it on two levels of a hill.
During an assault on a hill, I was hit in the right leg 4 times by a Russian burp gun. When I was hit, I just dropped my rifle and started rolling back toward the bottom of the hill. And I got about halfway down and kind of got in little rocky ravine-like, and so he opens up on me again, and I start rolling again. And I got to the bottom and of the hill, and I had to hobble out by myself.
A Doughfoot from Charlie Company of the 38th Infantry, with a jaw too fractured to eat with, but serviceable for talking about how it happened.
I guess it was a mortar round that got me, because I didn't see any grenade land anywhere near us. And I got my fractured jaw and my cheek, and I got shrapnel on the side. Now, I don't remember much after that, but they, when I was laying there, after they bandaged me, I can remember all the bullets near right over our heads. And they had to move us back, but I guess they held out the position, and the next morning I woke up, and I guess they had really piled up the chinks.
Of the 68,000 names on the casualty list, 11,505 are dead. Of those still living, many are still fighting. Others are at evacuation hospitals, base hospitals, general hospitals in Taegu and Tokyo. And many are back at our great service hospitals here in the United States. And there are the amputees. This war, like the last, presents the problem of the amputee in his adjustment to civilian life. And we, flamboyant, unpredictable nation that we are, do things in extremes. There were two of those casualties in the news this week. One, a quadruple amputee in Walter Reed Hospital, who was presented with $120,000 raised by his fellow citizens. He is PFC Robert Smith of Pennsylvania, and he doesn't know what to do with that much money.
I want to thank the people who sent me gifts. I hear there's something like $120,000 in the kitty right now. That's a nice kitty. It folks as well. When you're waiting for your arms and legs, don't think much spending money.
And in Nashville, Tennessee, an 18-year-old veteran of that tiny army, which in July of last year held the Noctong River line, and now says he can't get a job in civilian life because he lost a leg in Korea. He has but one solution.
When I went home, I decided it's about time to go to work, so I went and applied for a job. I was told that I couldn't get a job with them because they couldn't use amputees. I then decided I would get back into the Army. I liked the Army while I was in before, and from now on, the Army is my home.
There is an Army regulation that permits disabled veterans to serve in special jobs in the armed forces. For hour after hour, Monday through Friday, the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, sat before two Senate committees and answered questions. The Republicans in Washington long ago made it known that they were eager to question the Secretary. And this week, Mr. Acheson, through his testimony, revealed that he was eager to explain his policy. As he discussed our diplomatic activities and history from Iran around the world to Moscow, the Secretary attempted to answer one charge frequently made against him by Republican critics. The charge that we had sold out the Chinese nationalists to the communists. On this, Mr. Acheson was specific. The Yalta Agreement of 1945, which gave the Russians concessions in Manchuria, was the result of the desire by our military leaders to make certain of Soviet participation in the war against Japan. Chiang Kai-shek welcomed it, and Mr. Acheson said it had nothing to do with the later triumph of Red China. The Secretary placed the blame for the fall of the nationalist government on Chiang Kai-shek, his inept political and military leadership, and the lack of will to fight among his troops. And Mr. Acheson said that it was Chiang Kai-shek who originated the idea of working out a deal with the Chinese communists, a move that was supported by Generals MacArthur and Wedemeyer and Admiral Spruance. Mr. Acheson returns to the committee rooms tomorrow for his eighth day of testimony. In a less spectacular but perhaps more important battle now being fought in Washington, economic stabilizer Eric Johnston spoke about those who campaign against price controls.
Frankly, I think these people are afflicted with a mixture of astigmatism, wishful thinking, and a burning desire for business as usual, and at a time which is perhaps the most critical in all of our history. We're sitting on an economic time bomb. Business as usual has an ominous ring to me at a time when men are dying in battle in Korea for a free way of life.
President Truman was less pessimistic.
The government has tightened up on inflationary consumer credit and installment buying, and is moving to restrain inflationary bank credit. The government has put price and wage controls into effect. These government actions, together with voluntary action by consumers and businessmen, have stopped the upward rush of prices. Since early February, when the general ceiling price regulation went into effect, wholesale prices have increased less than 1%. During the last month, they have actually declined. Consumer prices have leveled off and fruit prices have come down a little.
25 years ago, in June of 1926, Brown University awarded an honorary degree to the conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. A Russian refugee, incapable of expressing his gratitude in his adopted tongue, Serge Koussevitzky acknowledged his degree by playing a solo on the double bass. His original instrument was the double bass. Since his arrival in Boston in 1924, Dr. Koussevitzky's instrument has been the Boston Symphony Orchestra. He took the strings, the woodwinds, the horns, the percussion instruments, and welded them into what was one of the best musical organizations in the world. Yesterday, the string section of the Boston Symphony played for the maestro for the last time. In rites devoid of dirge and threnody, they buried him. And the string section of the orchestra he had loved and bullied into greatness played his favorite music, the Andante Cantabile by Tchaikovsky. A year ago, in one of his rare radio interviews, recorded at his home in Lenox near Tanglewood, Dr. Koussevitzky said this about his future and other jobs.
I give up the Boston Symphony Orchestra in Boston as director, not to take your place. I don't want to have any responsibility apart from Tanglewood. Tanglewood, it is my child. It is my creation. It is my blood and tears. And Tanglewood I will never give up.
Two of America's five-star generals spoke this week. General Marshall to the class of 1951 at West Point, General Eisenhower on the beaches of Normandy on the 7th anniversary of D-Day. First, Secretary of Defense George Marshall reminding America's future generals about a basic American principle.
I think it is not the occasion, and it's a little too early, to comment on some of the difficulties you're going to have. There will be many. You will be misunderstood time and again. You will find it exceedingly difficult at times to compose the democratic procedures of this country with the military pattern which you feel to be necessary. But we're in a democracy, and I ask you never to forget that you are an officer in an army of a democracy. And only by your generous understanding of the position that an officer holds in a great democracy such as ours will lead you to a successful career. It is very necessary that you understand the workings of a democracy as applied to our military forces. I wish you the best of luck. May God bless you.
On June 6th, General Eisenhower went back to have a look at the beaches he had once commanded, at the rusting hulks of ships and LSDs still lying offshore at Omaha and Utah, looked at the huge cemetery above the shelving beach, and drove again on the narrow roads between the hedgerows, and said,
"Citizens of a free world, the proudest, the most precious title by which I can address you. It is a title that we could not use except for the men who sleep out in this field forever, except for men who, like them, lie in unnumbered graves throughout the world. Here in Normandy, it is particularly fitting that we commemorate the glory and the sacrifice of the liberation. For you were eyewitnesses, and your towns bear mute testimony to the tragic cost that must be paid to regain freedom once freedom has been lost. The young men of the Allied force who died in the hedgerows, their wounded fellows, those of your families and friends who fell in war, your ravaged homes and fields, all these are part of the price which we of the West have paid. Today, the West is united to defend freedom before freedom is lost. Freedom is not won and forever possessed. It must be re-earned every day and every generation.
You are listening to Hear It Now, CBS's weekly document for air based on the week's news. The program continues immediately after this pause for station identification. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. This is Program 26 on Hear It Now, a full-hour review of the week's news told in the actual recorded voices of the men and women who make the news. Once again, here is the editor of Hear It Now, Edward R. Murrow.
A few minutes ago from Boston, you heard the sound of a great orchestra. Men trained for music, civilians with souls, artists combining their talents to transmit to others the inspiration of its creator. Goethe once said, "Every man hears only what he understands." Now we invite you to hear what you cannot understand. That is a possible instrument of destruction and death, tuning up, and now taking off. It is a guided missile. Just as the strings and woodwinds, the percussion instruments, and the horns of a Boston symphony tell you something, the sounds you hear now, 46 different sounds, are telling something to a select few of America's top military scientists. You are listening to the firing of a rocket in New Mexico at the Army Ordnance Base at White Sands. We are permitted to describe it to you as a step toward the ultimate objective of having adequate guided missiles to do various practical missions for the Army. We believe you are listening to the prototype of a deadly weapon. We know that this rocket is fired from the ground, aimed at a target many miles away. It could be used to hit anything beyond the range of conventional artillery, troop concentrations, a warship, arsenals, cities. You are listening to the most modern military music, unheard by any soldier on any battlefield, but a step forward in designing a weapon to make the soldier's task simpler. These sounds may coincide with other sharps or flats you have heard, but they are not. You are listening to sounds that signify much to the scientist. These sounds, radioed from the rocket to the experts on the ground, are the sound of temperature and pressure, vibration and speed, heat and friction. 5 tons of rocket, with a half ton of instruments, are hurtling through space to tell the scientists in secret factories throughout the land that a new weapon of war is on the way, a surface-to-surface missile. It is steered by radar signals from the ground. Sometime in the future, it will lose its tinkling melody and its delicate theme. It will fly, if it must, over enemy lands, with the primary purpose of destruction. An instrument that will end its career in its own type of glorious crescendo, demolishing building or brick or structure of steel, and perhaps producing as its supreme triumph in its explosion the agonized cry of the hurt human being. You have have heard the prototype of a deadly weapon. Goethe said, every man hears only what he understands. Hank Greenberg, Ed Lopat, and a black cat combined to make news this week. The Cleveland Indians are a baseball club. Ed Lopat is a pitcher for the New York Yankees. The Cleveland team has not been able to win a ball game from Ed Lopat since June 19, 1949. After 11 straight losses to Lopat, Hank Greenberg, general manager of the Indians, decided that something drastic would have to be done. As Greenberg put it,
about a week ago, a Cleveland Indian fan wrote a letter telling the way to beat Ed Lopat is to come up with a novel idea or sponsor a contest and give a prize to the person who could best suggest him how to beat this pitcher that's been giving us all the trouble. The prize-winning suggestion was offered by a gentleman who stated that he thought it was nothing more than a superstition, and that if we had the rabbit's feet out at home plate and he would provide the live rabbits as well as distribute some 15,000 rabbit's feet to the spectators or as they came through the turnstiles.
This plot to beat Lopat, quite by coincidence, of course, jammed the ballpark. The rabbit's feet, incidentally, were flown in from New York. Just before play ball, there were added festivities.
Looking down in the field, the ground crew had just brought a box up to the pitcher's mound, opened the box, and two or three rabbits jumping out. The ground crew out there with that box, and they're trying to chase the rabbits around the infield.
The Yankees scored two runs in their half of the first. Then Lopat took the mound to find a 10th Indian in the Cleveland lineup.
Well, a fan has just come out of the stands, and he has a little black cat with him, and he drops it there, and he's going to throw a ball into the plate. Umpires go over and try to help him out. He brought a little black kitten out and dropped it right there at Lopat's feet. He's getting a nice hand from the crowd.
From there on in, Lopat was in trouble. With two out and two men on, the cat, the 15,000 rabbit's feet, and the Indians proved to be too much for the undefeated Mr. Lopat.
Last half of the first with two out. Lopat makes ready. He pitches. It's swung on. A fly ball going into left field. Going back for it is Woodling. Still going back. It's going for a home run.
Over cheers in the dressing room, our Cleveland reporter was about to record pitcher Lopat when a stormy, defeated Yankee manager Casey Stengel stopped the proceedings. Lopat ain't talking, he said. I'm the manager of this ball club. It was a dirty trick they pulled with that cat. I ought to protest the whole game. 1951 will probably go down as the year America once again began sending her young people overseas. Once again the transports went out to Korea, Japan, Okinawa, Hawaii, Indochina, to Alaska, the Canal Zone, to England and Germany and North Africa, to 100 different points on a smoldering globe. Americans prayed for peace, but began building and deploying the strength that means victory in war. 3 weeks ago, the 4th Infantry Division began moving from its home base at Fort Benning, Georgia, to its new base somewhere in Germany. We followed the 4th through every step of its 5,000 and some odd mile journey, and recorded the sounds of the voyage and the feeling of the men who made the trip. What you're about to hear is the story of the 18,000 men of the 4th, the 1st American Division sent from the U.S. to join General Eisenhower's United European Command. Fort Benning, Georgia. The word to move has been around for some weeks. The training stopped. The packing began. The heavy tanks and anti-aircraft guns rolled onto freight cars and preceded the troops to the POE, point of embarkation. Now it is time for the men to leave. The march to the trucks, the hot, dusty ride to the station, the assignment to trains.
All right, Sergeant First Class Babbitt, you grab your equipment. You're train 8. You're just this side of Sergeant Delgado. You have 26 men.
The long trip to the north, to Richmond, Washington, Philadelphia. Destination Camp Kilmer, near New Brunswick, New Jersey. The final processing for overseas duty, the forms, insurance, ID cards, the medical inspections, and inevitable shock. The briefing session. 18,000 men cannot be transported in one group, so the outfit arrives in waves. As soon as one contingent clears Kilmer and ships out, A second and third and fourth will take its place.
Bentley! Martin! Harris Eugene!
4 days is the average stay at Kilmer. 24 hours are on pass. The word comes through, passes at 1,700 today. The final brush of the shoes in the barracks. And off for New York City for that last fling in the States.
Hey, let's go! Over,
for the past month, it's been one going-away splurge after another. On $80 a month, there's not much left for the big party in New York, but somehow the money is found. Corporal Edward H. Dickerson of Amarillo, Texas, and PFC Marvin A. Kress of Wingo, West Kentucky, went through New York and $100 together. We went along for the ride down Fifth Avenue in a taxi, now approaching the Washington Square Arch.
Dixon here that I'd spent already $100 before I ever got into the state of New York. It cost me $100 and I never had even been into the state.
Well, the only times that I'd been up here were to see the World Series in 41-3 whenever the Yankees played. We came up to see them.
They've closed every burlesque show here in town. The boys were sure disappointed about that. They were hunting them.
They go to the farewell party thrown by the Vanderbilt Hotel for the Ivy Division. IV, from the Roman numerals for four.
The year's gone by as quickly as a wink. Enjoy yourself later than a day.
They ride the subways.
I find the subways in Wingo, Kentucky are somewhat different from this. The thing most that I can't figure out is who did all this digging.
They go up to the tower of the Empire State Building.
This is the highest. There's nothing this high in Texas, I'll say that.
I just wonder if I could see home in Kentucky from here.
That's the Hudson River over there.
Where's Brooklyn?
See the Statue of Liberty right out here?
Hey, Haynes, here's the Statue of Liberty.
I think the highest building in Arkansas, just 14 stories.
Not an oil well in town. I don't see how these people live.
And they wind up in a honky-tonk on Times Square. Amarillo, Texas makes time.
My name's Ed.
Well, hello.
How are you? Where are you from?
Montreal, Canada.
Oh, that's a long ways from my home. I'm from Texas.
No kidding.
Texas, big state. What do you do here in New York?
I'm just looking around at the big city.
Don't you think if we're going to be friends, I ought to know your name?
Well, it would help, wouldn't it?
It would help a lot, I think.
My name is Shirley.
Well, how are you, Shirley? We're shipping out Friday.
How can you bear to leave all those horses down in Texas?
Well, it was pretty hard. I left trails of tears from Texas to Georgia. Finally broke away.
It's a lot of tears. I hear Texas is a pretty big place.
Texas is a tremendous place, but I never saw anything like you in Texas.
Maybe it's not big enough, huh?
I don't think it is. I think Canada maybe is a better place.
Well,
what I was thinking is, since this is my last night in town and you seem to be here by yourself, we might make a night of it. Go out and have a few drinks, dance a while.
Final preparations. Briefing on the parade up Broadway. Assignments to ship and departure time. Final briefing.
Hold on! Double time in there, let's go! Right, at ease, man. This afternoon, there will be no passes until we get further notice. You wash your clothes, all of your dirty clothes, your fatigues, underclothes, particularly your belts. Belts are going to show tomorrow or the other day in the parade. Shine your brass. Get all your equipment lined up. Start and complete your packing tonight. That's all your whole baggage, your duffel bag.
From Kilmer to Manhattan. New York gives its traditional greeting. The spectators look on soberly. They seem happier about homecomings than departures. The hills and valleys of Broadway re-echo the sounds of the Fourth's own band. New York's Mayor Impellitteri bids them goodbye.
To each of you young men, I say, God be with you. Your nation and this, its greatest city, salute you.
Departure time. Pier 1, Staten Island. The lead ship, the General Alexander M. Patz of the Military Sea Transportation Service, 22,000 tons, 22 knot cruising speed, peacetime capacity, 1,500 troops. At the gangplank, checking the men aboard.
All right, when you get at the bottom of the gangplank, gentlemen, sound back with your first name and middle initial as I call your last name. When you get aboard, go into the hold, get on your sack, your baggage, and stay there. Allen.
Jackie.
Archer.
Williams.
Benalos.
Frank.
Beckley.
Thomasy.
Begley.
Harmony.
Benjamin.
Felder.
Up the gangplank. The band strikes up on the pier. The men are in good spirits. Aboard ship, the last official visitors are cleared off.
That's all for the gangway. All that's sure is going ashore. All that's sure is going ashore. That's all for the gangway.
Well, I wonder how they'll bring us back with a big brass band. If you get back, you'd be damn lucky to get back in a rowboat.
Come on, get that tub going.
Yay, hey, we're moving.
Oh, we're moving. Oh, you lucky people.
There we go,
that's
that.
Yeah,
there she blows.
Oh, look at all you
missing. Yeah.
Second time.
They listen for the song that spells goodbye. Down on the dock, as the ship slides free, they say goodbye. A few minutes out of the harbor, the normal ship routine is established. Policing, training, chow. Abandoned ship drill.
Your next signal will be the abandoned ship signal. The signal consists of seven short and one long on the bells and on the whistle. Seven short and a long on the bells and on the whistle. When you hear this signal, all hands will immediately proceed up to their abandoned ship stations.
Second day out. Quarters inspection, no good. Troop Commander Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Winder sounds off.
The inspection today at 1300, I think, was lousy. Exception of one compartment, and that was number 8.
Down the line goes the word. First Sergeant Latman is grieved. He informs the 250 men in compartment C5 of this fact. The ventilator whines in the background.
Bringing this meeting to its third meeting. You all probably know what it's for. For one simple thing, the compartment, the cleanliness of the compartment, the troops themselves, how they conduct themselves, and so forth and so on. I orientated you men quite thoroughly on my second orientation of what was expected of each man in compartment C5. Each man had a specific job to do on his 10-day voyage on this vessel. Is that not right? You were well informed, well trooped, that there'll be no sleeping on your damn bunks with your shoes on. And yet we went around and found we did not wake the man up. 10 to 15 and possibly 20 men with their damn shoes on. Now, if you men can't understand English, we can certainly keep you down in this compartment at C5 24 hours a day.
Third day out. KPs prepare the morning chow.
Red, you give the eggs out. One of your potatoes here. One of you get on the mush. Got the coffee over there. We have a juice. And one of you give out the fresh milk we have this morning.
The chow line moves along.
What do you order, juice, boys?
Plenty juice.
Roll along, boys. Roll along. Right around the corner.
Not all the men make chow.
I feel wicked. How's the old saying go? Two down and two up. I had two meals. Two went down, two came up. Only thing is, it took me three times in 5 minutes.
Private Danny Marino of New York feels somewhat seasick, too. He goes down to sick bay. Some men say Danny likes to go to sick bay. Alan, the corpsman, announces him to the nurse.
Miss Alster, Private Marino is seasick.
Marino, how long have you been seasick?
Besides, I've been seasick for about 4 days now since entering this vessel ship. I really can't go about my work. I try and everything.
You mean you got seasick right after you left the harbor?
I got seasick when I knew I was coming on a boat. I couldn't understand it. I just can't seem to go about my work. Everybody looks green to me. I talk to people. They seem to just be going round and round. And then they all come out with bobbing and weaving. I haven't been eating my foods. Food. I haven't been eating in a...
You, don't look too sick. I mean, you're up on your feet right now.
I was dragged into it. I got a hold on to something. I can't walk around.
Well, I admit the ship's rolling quite a bit now, is more than it has been the whole trip.
Well, am I going to get worse, though?
Well, I don't know. You know, they say you always get worse before you get better. But we have some other Dramamine that we can give you, but you'll have to take it rectally.
Oh, it's a little fast for me. Down from New York. I don't understand this.
Oh, are you from Brooklyn?
Brooklyn.
Oh, wow. Well, I guess we'll have to have Alan come over here and tell you.
Alan?
Yes, my corpsman.
Oh.
And he'll explain how to use this Dramamine, and if that doesn't work, then we'll have Doctor come down and take a look at you.
Private Marino might be called a character. There's one in every outfit. Expert at the high and noble art of griping. Great for the morale of the unit. Here he holds a sergeant and a corporal at bay.
Well, what don't you like about the Army?
Well, I'll tell you.
I don't like when they blow the whistle to get you up. I don't like when they blow the whistle for you to fall out. I don't like when they blow the whistle for you to eat. I don't like when they blow the whistle for you after you eat. There's no sense in that.
Well, that's discipline. You have to have discipline in the
discipline?
Army.
Discipline?
Right.
Why? Why is that?
Well, if you didn't have discipline in the Army, it'd just be a mob.
Mob?
Well, wait just a minute. Ask me one question. You don't like the Army, and yet you enlisted in it. Why did you do that? You're R.A. You enlisted
in it. Because the Army's a good deal.
The fourth is a fairly young outfit. Most men in their late teens or early 20s, mostly draftees. Men from every section of the country, every race, color, and creed. Many college men. Many serious men, like Sergeant Weber.
You know, we've been hearing a lot of talk ever since we left Georgia about why we're going to Europe, what we're going to do over there. And I don't know, I've been thinking about it. For a while, I was sort of taking it with a grain of salt. I thought perhaps it wasn't all what they said it was going to be, but after reading the papers for a while and reading about why we're going there, I'm getting to think that it's the only logical thing we can do. Those people over there, they need to have some help in the way of men and just boost their morale mainly.
The days roll by. It's a fast crossing. Life aboard ship consists of many things. Some work, some play. Reveille is individual at 6 a.m.
Let's get out of there.
Hey, what time of morning is it?
Huh?
What time of morning is it?
6 o'clock.
Hey.
Yeah, it's time to get up.
Hey,
time to get up, 6 o'clock.
Mama.
Are you? You awake?
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing, waiting here all night just for us guys to get up?
Oh, no, we just got up.
Yeah, what's that idea of waking us up?
It's time to get up.
I never got any sleep last night.
You didn't sleep last night?
Oh, that dang on a dang bed all night. They keep them falling out. This thing was bouncing all over the place.
Let's hit it. Time to get up.
Prop wash from the stern. German lessons.
And you address a person by name, you say, Mr. Schmidt, Herr Schmidt, Herr Schmidt, Herr Schmidt, Schmidt. Miss Schmidt means Fräulein Schmidt, Fräulein Schmidt, Fräulein Schmidt.
Radio Shack, weather reports. Stand guard duty.
Now, here's your special orders. This life preserver here, you unfasten it and throw it overboard. This red container down here, you unscrew this top, and when you throw the preserver overboard, it will light up a flare. The victim will be able to see the preserver. You holler, the man overboard.
Deck concert at high noon. The poker game.
Down and dirty. Two aces but $1.
$1. Call it. Run the cards.
Here they come.
One jack, no help. Another jack, no help. Two aces. Got a lot on the board.
The Coke machine and ping pong. A serenade at night. The division mascot, a dachshund. Variety show rehearsal.
Hey, fellas. Greetings to you from the 4th Infantry Division.
The big MacArthur debate.
If he becomes before president,
I think it'll be between him and General Eisenhower. One will be the next president of the United
States. Should
have
a general of the army or something like that running for president.
In a time of in times like these, I think yes.
Well, I don't know. I don't think so. I don't know. It might bring about a militaristic nation of some sort.
A Protestant chaplain conducts Jewish services. Morale mighty high below decks.
Well, I woke up in the morning with my head on the floor where I left it Saturday night. Making up my mind to sin no more. Start my Sunday ride.
Now, approaching England, a soldier looks out at the sea and spins a fabric of imagination and memory. His dream girl.
You want a guy, you want a gal that's, all kind of warm around the fireplace at night. And, she wants to be the, well, affectionate, you might say. A girl that can make you do things her way and make you think it's your way. Make you like it. I got the girl picked that I want to get took by. And she's just about everything I said that I wanted. She's got a nice, soothing voice. Take the winds whistling through the treetops. Take the rippling waters. You got her voice. Laugh. Well, when she laughs, it's kind of like the Harpo Marx in his harp. When he gets down to the serious music, he can really make that harp sing, and that's just about like her laugh is. Common sense, good loving, good looks, nice personality. It all totals up to the dream girl.
Landfall, England. The British pilot who will navigate the channel is piped aboard by a GI.
I say, Oba, how about coming aboard and have a spot of tea with us?
The white cliffs of Dover and the expected reaction. On the bridge, the pilot calls the signals approaching Bremerhaven, Germany.
We should make P-12 lightship at about
9:45. And round course to 174. All right, easy right wheel.
Easy right wheel.
Easy right now to 170.
The crossing is almost completed. It's been fast. 7 days, 12 hours. A record for the post-war military fleet. Smooth sailing most of the way, except for the tail end of a storm 5 days out. The general patch is eased into Bremerhaven Harbor. The men make a hasty visual reconnaissance of the ground ahead.
The gates, watch the chef.
Where's the chef?
Where's the chef?
Yeah, that one there. But the cathedral up there, it's bombed. You can still see the bombs inside of it where it was all beat up.
It'll start raining in a few minutes. That'll make everything just fine.
There must be a Kremlin guest house over there. Look at those Fräuleins sitting on a bench.
Wow.
Oh, there's the band. What's faster in German? Quick. Faster.
The journey across is about over. The debarkation, the military honors, the long speeches of welcome in the driving rain are yet to come. But one GI looked down from the deck of the General Patch and summed up the essential point of the whole operation in four words. Four words from a buck private in the 4th Infantry Division, United European Command.
Eisenhower, we are here.
The commander of the 4th Division, Major General Harlan N. Harkness, received the honors at Bremerhaven from General Eisenhower's staff and replied by saying a few words about his men.
This small group, which you see in front of you, is truly representative. It is symbolic. It symbolizes young America. It symbolizes young America at its best. It symbolizes the will and the determination of our people to join with the rest of the free people of this world to maintain freedom. These men and the other men of the 4th Division are fully conscious of their mission, and they are fully determined to accomplish that mission. We trust that that mission will continue to be peaceful, but I assure all those listening that should the turn be otherwise, the 4th Division will give a good account of itself.
You have just heard program 26 in the CBS series, Hear It Now, a document for ear based on the week's news. Hear It Now is edited and produced by Edwin R. Murrow and Fred W. Friendly, and the CBS staff, which includes Irving Gitlin, Jesse Zausma, John Aaron, Edmund Scott, and Joseph Werschfer. Portions of the program originated at WTOP Washington, WEEI Boston, WGAR Cleveland, WLAC Nashville, WRBL Columbus, Georgia, KNX Los Angeles, KCBS San Francisco, and The Voice of America. Combat recordings were made in Korea by CBS correspondent Robert Pierpoint and John Jefferson, and by Voice of America correspondents. The trip of the 4th Division from Benning to Bremerhaven was done with the general assistance of the armed forces, and particularly the Military Sea Transportation Service of the Navy Department, and correspondent Elmer Borzik. The original interview with Dr. Kusevitsky was done a year ago by James Fassett. The play-by-play baseball broadcast was by Jimmy Dudley. Edward R. Murrow can be heard over most of these same CBS stations Monday through Friday at 7:45 p.m. Eastern Time. Your announcer is Olin Tice. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.